Chapter 17.
I woke the next morning fully intending to visit the tailor as soon as I had washed my face and had a bite to eat. But no sooner had I dressed than a visitor arrived. "Who is it?" I asked. The slave, half asleep himself, mumbled the name Brutus. I told him to take the guest to the small library at one corner of the house, and soon thereafter headed to the room, expecting to find Marcus Brutus. I couldn't imagine what he had to say to me. Had my visit to his house ended too abruptly for his liking? That puzzle evaporated and was replaced by another as soon as I saw the visitor. Marcus Brutus, with his elegant comportment, seemed born to wear senatorial dress. This man, though about the same age as Marcus Brutus, had a very different bearing. He would be more at home in military armour, I thought, than his poorly fitted toga. He wore a neatly trimmed beard, as military men often do, saying they encounter enough dangerous blades in battle. His posture was stiff, and in his eyes was a look that proclaimed he had no time for nonsense. Junior officers would be terrified of such a man. "Do we know each other?" I asked.
"We do not," he answered. "That's why I've come, to meet you, as a courtesy."
This was not very enlightening. "You know my name, I take it, but I don't know yours." He grunted.
"Decimus Junius Brutus Albinus. I did give my name to the man at the door.
Apparently, four names are too many for the poor fellow to remember."
"Then he shouldn't be answering the door."
He grunted again, perhaps realizing it was rude for one man to lecture another about household slaves. "He did remember Brutus, since I saw Marcus Junius Brutus only yesterday. I thought perhaps different branch of the family," he said. "Yes, as that Albinus of the end would indicate. But likewise descended from the founder of the Republic." I nodded. "As a matter of fact, I think you look a bit more like that famous statue than does your cousin, Marcus, especially with the beard."
He touched it.
"It helps me to pass as a Gaul."
"Do you do that often?"
"On occasion."
"Ah, yes, I remember. You're the dictator's hand-picked man to govern Gaul. My son says you speak several Gaulish dialects better than the Gauls themselves."
He said something that must have been a Gaulish proverb, for when he saw my incomprehension, he translated, "To rule the henhouse, you must think like a rooster." The Gauls are very proud of their gaming cocks.
"Speaking of Gaul," I said,
"you and I were both in the vicinity of Massilia a few years back, when Caesar laid siege to it. I was trapped inside the walls. You commanded the fleet that destroyed the Massilian navy offshore. I saw some of the battle from the walls of the city, ships aflame, mangled bodies and blood amid the waves." "If you thought it looked ghastly from shore, you should have been on the water that day." He flashed an incongruous smile. "My son Mito does that sometimes too."
"What's that?"
"Smile when recalling something horrific." He shrugged. "It's the excitement. There's horror and the actual moment, but when a man thinks back, it's the excitement he recalls." "I should have thought it was the other way around." Decimus Brutus laughed. It was a hearty laugh, devoid of any rancor or irony. "Caesar said you were like that."
"Like what?"
"A deep one, he called you. Cut straight to the heart of the matter, practically a philosopher."
"I suppose I'm flattered that the dictator finds my character worthy of discussion, though I can't imagine why."
"I asked him about you, after he told me we're to dine together. Always nice to know a bit in advance. That's why I dropped by, just a casual visit. We can talk at greater length when we dine."
"What in Hades are you talking about?"
He raised his eyebrows. "Oh, I see. The invitation hasn't arrived yet. I thought, well,
Obviously, I got it wrong. My timing, I mean. Make that sort of error on a battlefield and men could die. He shut his mouth tightly and relaxed only when I smiled. Did Caesar not warn you that I can be rather perverse as well? When is this dinner that you speak of? I really should say no more, but it was my understanding that you and I will be attending the same dinner on the day after tomorrow.
Where?
At a location be decided.
How mysterious.
With whom?
The Caesar, of course.
I frowned.
That can't be right.
That's the night before the Senate meets. Caesar will have a great deal to do. He won't spend his time dining with me. I may have arrived with news ahead of the official invitation, but I didn't get the details wrong.
This was said with a military man's conviction.
We are both to dine with Caesar two nights hence, along with your son Mito.
That I find less surprising.
Mito can at least take notes for the dictator, but I should be quite useless at such a dinner.
He's doing it for Mito, of course.
What do you mean?
Your son is very important to Caesar. Caesar wishes to honour him, here in Rome, before the departure for the East, and to honour you as Mito's father.
I should think that what happens on the Ides will be honour enough.
He gave me a blank look, and for a long moment said nothing. Finally he drew a sharp breath and nodded.
You mean your elevation to the Senate?
What else?
Even so, I think we will soon be dinner companions. Ahead of the occasion, I thought I'd pay a call to introduce myself.
The man was a diplomat as well as a general, I thought. Both skills would be essential when it came to governing the numerous tribes of Gaul.
There's the guilty slave, he said, looking past me. I turned to see the slave who was tending the door. Decimus Brutus looked as if he expected me to thrash the miscreant then and there. The slave caught his look and flinched, though no one was near him.
Another visitor, master, your son.
You hardly need to announce Mito, I said, and a moment later opened my arms to embrace my son as he stepped into the room. The slave scurried out of the way and quickly vanished. Mito and Decimus Brutus acknowledged one another with curt nods. Neither seemed entirely surprised to see the other. Decimus Brutus no doubt surmised that Mito was the bearer of my dinner invitation, and Mito, with thinly veiled displeasure, surmised that his surprise had been spoiled. Decimus Brutus said a hasty farewell and left the library, saying he would see himself out.
He ruined my surprise, didn't he?
Said Mito. I'm afraid so. It's true, then. Dinner with the dictator two nights hence.
Mito smiled broadly.
I wanted to give you the news, but perhaps it's better that Decimus Brutus got here ahead of me. You don't always enjoy surprises.
Hardly ever. To an old man, there is no such thing as a friendly shock.
Are you quoting something?
Only the thoughts in my own head.
But, Papa, isn't it wonderful? It's to be a very formal dinner with lots of courses and some sort of entertainment or recitation, something very special, Caesar says, but also a very intimate affair, only six of us.
Only six?
I shall run out of conversation after the appetizer.
Nonsense.
You're the best conversationalist I know, after Caesar, that is.
You flatter me.
Not at all. Did Decimus have some other reason to visit you?
He said it was a courtesy call, to introduce himself ahead of the dinner.
Seems a bit odd, now that I think about it.
Not really, Papa. It's an old military habit, scouting the terrain ahead of time.
Decimus, no doubt, has his own agenda for the dinner. Political favours to ask of Caesar, that sort of thing. And never having met you, he's wondering just what sort of dinner companion you'll be. How much of Caesar's time will you take up? What sort of tone will you introduce, and so forth?
Well, it's not as if I'm some barbaric Gaulish chieftain.
Actually, the behaviour of a barbarian from Gaul would be easier for Decimus to anticipate. Caesar likes to say that Decimus has gone Gaul, the way some men are said to go Greek, when they become too at home with the natives and pick up local customs. I think Decimus feels a bit of an outsider when he's back here in Rome. Dealing with Gauls is easy for him now. Dealing with his fellow Romans requires effort. The more Roman the Roman, the greater the effort. And there is no Roman more Roman than you, Papa, except Caesar. Again, you flatter me. He smiled. Besides telling you about the dinner invitation, I had another reason for calling on you. Yes? From the way he scanned the little library and then peered down the hallway, making sure we wouldn't be overheard, I knew what he was about to ask. You want to know if I've seen or sought out information about any of those men on Caesar's list? I said. Yes, Papa. As a matter of fact, I have. But I've nothing of substance to report. Which of them have you seen? Yesterday I paid calls on Brutus, the other one, and Antony. Oh, and I saw Cassius as well, but only in passing. He was at his brother-in-law's house when I happened to call. Anyone else? Only Cinna, who most certainly is not on Caesar's list. Oh, and Decimus Brutus, just now, who isn't on the list either. I suppose Caesar must trust him as much as he does you, since you'll both be at this dinner party. Yes, Decimus is the last person Caesar would suspect of treachery. And your impressions? I shrugged. If anything, I'd say the wives pose the biggest danger to Caesar. Mito snorted. I'm quite serious. Let me explain. Chapter 18 It is hard for me to see Brutus as a threat to Caesar, I continued, except for one thing, the fact that he's now married to Cato's daughter and subject to her influence. If Portia is anything like her father, she detests the dictator and everything he stands for, and almost certainly she blames Caesar for her father's suicide. Cato never let go of a grudge, like father, like daughter. Cato didn't have to die, said Mito. He could have surrendered, Caesar would have pardoned him. Perhaps, but Cato preferred what he considered an honourable death to the dishonour of submitting to a tyrant. Many people respect Cato for that, whether they sided with him or not. As you may recall, when Caesar, in his African triumph, paraded a gory image of Cato gutting himself with a knife, many people were offended, and not just Cato's supporters. There may have been some who thought that picture was in poor taste. I was there, Mito. I heard the booing. Of course, I don't know how greatly Portia influences her husband. But there's also the fact that Brutus himself is Cato's nephew, and his mother is Cato's sister. Servilia is a formidable woman by any measure. Remember what I said about Cato and grudges, like brother, like sister? Mito frowned. You make it sound as if Cato poses a threat to Caesar from beyond the grave. That's one way of putting it. The dead do have a habit of taking vengeance on the living. Of course, once Caesar is off to Parthia, the excitement of the new war will supplant the bitterness of the old war. No one will remember dead Cato if Caesar returns with a living Parthian king in chains to be paraded in yet another triumph. This idea made Mito smile. And then there's Fulvia, I said. Another woman? Yes, and even more formidable, I suspect, than Portia or Servilia. Not even Fulvia could turn Antony against Caesar. No. I think she has even more sway over her husband than does Portia over Brutus. And she's driven by something stronger than any grudge. Ambition.
I mean the sort of grand, earth-shaking ambition that Caesar himself possesses. Ambition that transcends marriages and military alliances, disappointment and death. Ambition that only grows stronger each time it's thwarted. You make Fulvia sound almost supernatural, like a fury, or some sorceress from the myths, like Medea. I raised an eyebrow. I wouldn't be at all surprised if she practices sorcery of some sort. She also has a veritable army of spies, informants she's known and nurtured for years, since her first marriage to Clodius. But could Fulvia turn Antony against Caesar? The two men have had their ups and downs. Antony must be disappointed that he's not accompanying Caesar to Parthia. He'll have the honour of governing Rome instead, which he's done before, not entirely to Caesar's liking, which caused the last rift between them. If Antony were to turn against Caesar, Fulvia would make a powerful ally. Mito looked thoughtful. You also saw Cassius? Briefly, at Brutus's house, whirling his little nephew in the air. He seemed harmless enough, though he did give the child a nosebleed. And Decimus Brutus, who's not on Caesar's list. And Cinna. I sighed. Far from posing a threat, Cinna seems disposed to do anything the dictator asks, no matter how radical. You must know about this legislation he intends to introduce on Caesar's behalf, allowing the dictator to take as many wives as he wishes. Mito smiled. That law is likely to be the first piece of legislation on which Senator Gordianus will be called to vote. I groaned. Perhaps I won't be inducted until late in the day, after the law's been voted on. I suspect your induction will take place early on, so don't count on missing the vote. Caesar likes to test the loyalty of a new senator as soon as possible, and voting in favour of that measure will certainly be a test. But I thought Cinna was your friend. Cinna is my drinking companion. Because we share the occasional cup of wine doesn't mean I want to support his political ambitions, whatever they may be. I've never even read the man's poems.
You haven't?
Mito peered at me in disbelief.
But, Papa, how is that possible? Everyone's read the Smyrna.
No, Mito, not everyone, because I haven't read it. He leaned back and stared at me, genuinely taken aback. He scanned the shelves around us.
Amid all these scrolls, there's no copy of the Smyrna. People say Cinna is the world's greatest living poet.
Is that your opinion as well, Mito? The writer himself, having helped Caesar recount his military campaigns, my son had strong ideas about both poetry and prose.
With Catullus gone, yes. I know Caesar thinks so.
I'm surprised a dictator has time to read. I don't. I still haven't managed to reach the end of Caesar's Gallic War. Despite loving Mito, I sometimes found his collaborations with Caesar a bit of a slog, with too much detail about siege engines and trench digging and other minutiae of warfare.
Then by Hercules, Papa, put aside the Gallic War and pick up the Smyrna.
Although, yes, you might not like it after all.
Not to your taste, perhaps.
How so?
For one thing, the language. Very ornate and deliberately obscure, loaded with convoluted metaphors and antiquated words. Beautiful to hear, but often difficult to comprehend.
But what was Cicero's critique?
Certain poets pay more attention to sound than to sense.
So, not everyone agrees with you and Caesar about Cinna's greatness.
Cicero might not think Cinna great, but he's read him, nonetheless. The language is certainly difficult. Also, given your sentiments on certain subjects, your deeply felt sense of right and wrong, what has that to do with Cinna?
Papa, do you have any idea what the Smyrna is about?
Mito's tone was at once exasperated and sad.
Well, no, to be honest, I haven't a clue.
Incest?
Now I was taken aback. "What do you mean, incest?"
"Well, in this case, between a father and daughter.
You do know who Smyrna was?"
"Oh, I've heard of her, of course. There's a Greek city with that name, though I usually see it spelled with a Latin S instead of the Greek Z, and I'm not sure the city has anything to do with the girl. As for her story..." I shook my head.
"Something to do with myrrh? I seem to recall that the word myrrh is somehow derived from Smyrna."
"Papa, what a muddle your mind must be."
Mito sat back and folded his arms.
"The Smyrna isn't unique or even unusual, the incest theme, I mean. It's part of a whole genre of incest poems, forbidden and unusually tragic love between fathers and daughters, mothers and sons, sisters and brothers."
"Tragic?"
"Someone usually ends up dead, or metamorphosed by a god into something not human, as happens in the Smyrna."
"The death or the metamorphosis?"
"Both. But seriously, Papa, have you never read Parthenius, or Euphorion, or..."
"Seriously, Mito, I have not.
They're merely names to me, I told you, son. I have no time to read modern poetry."
His face brightened.
"Well then, now I know what I must give you for your birthday. It falls on the 23rd day of this month, doesn't it?"
"I think so."
"Are you not sure?"
"Where's anyone sure of his birth date any more, after all that fiddling Caesar did with the calendar? Adding 60 days to the year of his triumphs, which meant my next birthday was postponed for 60 days, and I actually turned 65 60 days before the 23rd day of Martius arrived last year. Thanks to the dictator, even a man's birthday is no longer his own."
"On the contrary, Papa, by fixing the calendar, Caesar restored each man's birthday to its rightful date and season. Remember how badly the old calendar had fallen behind the actual seasons? The old calendar had lost 60 days, so that your birthday was falling in the actual month of Januarius. Never mind that the calendar read Martius.
But last year, thanks to Caesar, the 23rd of Martius arrived when it should.
Still, it seemed quite strange that a man could be, say, 30 years old one day and 29 the next, if his birthday happened to fall at midnight on the day before Caesar added the extra 60 days.
Now you're just being nonsensical, Papa. But since you don't trust the new calendar, I won't wait until the 23rd to give you your present. We shall go and get it right now."
"Go where?"
"Don't you need to shop for your new toga?"
"Well, I'm told I should purchase it from a certain Mamercus, and no one else."
"But you can't buy my toga for me?"
"I don't intend to. I know where that shop is located, on a street with a number of other very exclusive establishments, including the most prestigious bookseller in Rome. I shall buy the Smyrna as a gift for you, and you shall read it tonight."
"Nonsense. I can buy it for myself."
"Don't be ungracious, Papa."
This came from Diana, who happened to be passing by the doorway and paused to look in.
"You're so hard to shop for, the man who wants for nothing because he wants nothing. If Mito knows of a book you might like, by all means let him have the pleasure of purchasing it for you. What's the title? I'm not sure I heard it correctly."
"Smyrna, a very famous poem by Papa's drinking companion Cinna. Have you heard of it?"
"With 2 children and a husband to look after, I've even less time for poetry than Father does. Perhaps you can read it aloud to me, Papa."
"Or perhaps not," I said, considering the subject matter.
"Which is?"
"Never mind. Shall we be off, Mito? We have shopping to do."
Chapter 19.
If there had ever been any ironmongers on the street of the ironmongers, they had departed long ago, driven out by rising rents. The street was just off the Forum, on the Suburra side,
the Suburra being Rome's most crowded, dirtiest, and most dangerous neighbourhood. Some speculator in real estate realized that if one walled off the north end of the street, so that it no longer opened to the Suburra, the street of the ironmongers could be entered only from the forum. The wall was erected, and gone now were the petty thieves, drunkards and beggars who could no longer scuttle off into the wilds of the Suburra at a moment's notice. Taking their place were muscle-bound slaves who loitered in the street, trying to look inconspicuous as they kept an eye on the clientele and guarded the expensive goods of their masters. I had intended to visit the tailor first, to be done with my toga shopping, but Mito was so eager to acquire the Smyrna that I allowed him to lead me straight to a bookseller at the very end of the street, next to the wall. The shop smelled of ink and papyrus and wood shavings. Pigeonhole shelves along the walls were stuffed with scrolls. Some were merely rolled and tied with ribbons, but others were wound around dowels with handles made of wood or ivory. "Ivory rollers for books," I muttered. "Who could afford such a luxury? What words could justify the expense?" "Ivory handles speak less about the book and more the man purchasing the book," said a wizened little man behind the counter. His keen eyes peered out of a wrinkled face that terminated in a huge beard not quite as grey as my own. I had reached the age where many an elderly fellow I encountered wasn't yet as elderly as myself. "I'm Simonides, the proprietor of this shop," he said. "We offer books suitable for every reader and every level of wealth, books for old or young, books for men of all sorts, and even books for women. As you noted, we supply ivory handles, wooden handles, or no handles at all. Bring your own rollers and we'll mount the scroll for you. We also offer the fastest and most accurate copying service in Rome. Small jobs like letters or love poems can be done while you wait." He gestured to an open door behind him, through which I could see a number of scribes bent over small tables. The scratching of styluses across papyrus made a quiet but steady rasping noise. "We are looking for a particular book," said Mito. "A poem." "Yes," said Simonides. "We handle all the finest poets, both Latin and Greek. The Smyrna of Helvius Cinna." "Oh," exclaimed a little man. "What a wise choice you made when you chose to visit the bookshop of Simonides. This happens to be the only place in Rome where discriminating readers can purchase a copy of the Smyrna. We are the exclusive copyists for the works of Helvius Cinna." "Is that a fact?" I said. "It is." "I should have thought a poet would want his words to be distributed as widely as possible, available in every bookshop." "Some poets, perhaps," the little man said sourly, "and all the politicians, that's for sure. They want everyone, everywhere, to read every word of their memoirs. Some of those books I can't give away." I glanced at Mito. Before he could ask if the bookseller had a copy of Caesar's Civil Wars, I steered the conversation back to Cinna. "But you do have a copy of the Smyrna?"
"I'll have to check," Simonides said thoughtfully. "As I was saying, some poets would hawk their wares on every street corner in the Suburra, but Cinna is quite the opposite. His work is so refined, so complex, it's really accessible only to the keenest intellect."
"I've been told that Cicero thinks Cinna makes a lot of sound but not much sense."
"The sound of Cinna? Well, yes,
It's ravishing, isn't it? To hear those words read aloud is to succumb to a kind of music, to a song like the siren sang. As for making sense, before Cicero dares to critique a work by Cinna, he might wish to expand his own vocabulary and reacquaint himself with some of the lesser-known, but no less potent, myths. Jupiter knows what Cicero will make of Cinna's forthcoming poem.
"There's to be a new poem by Cinna," I said, curious to hear what the bookseller knew about it.
"Indeed there is." Simonides lowered his voice and gave us a conspiratorial look. "Rumour has it that this new work will eclipse even the Smyrna. The poet drops by this shop from time to time, and has on occasion uttered a line or two from the forthcoming poem, teasing me, as it were, each line sublime in itself, so that one can only imagine the exalted magnitude of the complete poem."
"Something about Orpheus, isn't it, and Pentheus?" I said innocently. Simonides gave me a blank look.
"Is it? Cinna never told me that. He's always very guarded about the subject matter. Says he doesn't want some other poet to overhear and steal his idea."
He cocked his head.
"Who did you say you are?"
"Apologies," said Mito. "We failed to introduce ourselves. This is Gordianus, Senator Gordianus, and I am his son."
The bookseller gave me a reappraising look, and though I wasn't in senatorial garb, he seemed to accept Mito's word. His eyes glittered.
"But it's the Smyrna you're asking for. As I said, I shall have to check my stock. I don't keep a copy on the shelves for customers to freely peruse. Even these days, there's the occasional ignoramus who's likely to pick up the Smyrna, scan a few lines, turn all red and flustered, and then loudly accuse me of selling filth and ruining public morals. You know the sort, country bumpkins who haven't read a book since Sulla's memoirs, who wander in here only because their wives have sent them into town to buy a cookbook." Simonides shuddered. "But let me go and see."
He disappeared into the back room. Mito and I browsed the scrolls for sale. On one shelf I came across a play by Euripides I had never read or seen performed, Phaethon. I was tempted to suggest that Mito should buy it for my gift instead of the Smyrna, which was sounding less appealing to me the more I heard about it. Mito, meanwhile, was pleased to find an entire shelf filled with works by Caesar. Not only the war memoirs, but also a number of his speeches and tracts, including Against Cato. There were also some of his youthful works, a poem called The Praises of Hercules, and a play about Oedipus in verse. Simonides returned with a broad smile on his face, and in his hands a long, narrow linen pouch. From the drawstring that cinched the pouch dangled a tag, on which I could clearly read in red letters, Smyrna and Cinna.
"Fortuna smiles on you today, my friend. This is my very last copy of the Smyrna. The chief scribe tells me another won't be ready until the eyes of Aprilis."
Mito moved to take the pouch, but I gently deflected him. "And surely, Mito, we shouldn't take this copy. If Simonides is the exclusive seller, and will have no more after this, then for a whole month no one else will be able to purchase the Smyrna. I shouldn't deprive Cinna of a new reader."
"Papa, you are the new reader," said Mito. "Don't you see? This scroll was meant for you. The fates brought us here today."
"As for being out of stock for a while," said Simonides, The sinner won't mind. He knows that scarcity adds to the book's appeal.
How so? I asked.
Sinner is happy for his words to reach only those readers capable of fully appreciating them. If a book as special as the Smyrna isn't available on a given day, such a reader will persevere, returning as many times as necessary to lay hands on the unique object of his desire. He will appreciate it all the more for the effort required to obtain it. Rarity and exclusivity only add to the mystique of a work already so rarefied and so exquisite.
Imagine a beautiful woman, Papa, said Mito. If she gives herself to every man she meets, is she any less beautiful?
No.
But less desirable?
Almost certainly.
Then imagine a beautiful woman for whom you have to wait and who waits for only you. Is she not more desirable?
I shook my head. Well, I suppose I'll never understand great literature.
Maybe not, said Mito with a laugh. I'll be curious to see what you make of the Smyrna. He took the scroll from Simonides. I stepped outside while Mito paid for the book. After all his talk about scarcity and artistry, I feared Simonides would demand a steep price. But Mito looked pleased with himself when he joined me in the street.
If I told you the first price he named, you'd faint, he said. But when I explained who I was and who you are, in relation to Caesar, I mean, he lowered the price considerably.
Mito! I wouldn't want that fellow to take advantage of you, but on the other hand, I don't like the idea of you bullying shopkeepers by mentioning the dictator.
Papa, you misunderstand.
Caesar's books bring that fellow a great deal of business. He told me that the latest installment of the memoirs is the largest selling item he's ever had, and there's no fear of running low on stock, since Caesar's own copyists supply the shop. Simonides makes a very tidy profit on those sales. When I explained that I played a part in creating those books, he quite reasonably gave me a better price, an author's discount, if you like.
You take favoritism for granted, I said. I suppose that I, too, will have to get used to the fawning of my inferiors once I really am a senator.
I intended mild sarcasm, but Mito slapped me on the back and said,
"That's the spirit, Papa. Now, let's see how good a bargain we can strike on this new toga of yours."
Chapter 20
We crossed the street and stepped into the establishment of Mamercus, the tailor. The large vestibule was as sparse as a bookshop had been cluttered. Mamercus dealt in nothing but togas, so there were no women's or children's garments on display, and only a few pristine specimens of the shop's handiwork hung on the walls. The floor was a mosaic of green, white, and black tiles. The geometric pattern was subtle, so as not to distract from the goods on offer, but laid with exquisite craftsmanship. We approached a long tiled counter on which was repeated the geometric pattern of the floor. The quiet shop felt very elegant and fearfully expensive. The man behind the counter had longish red hair and was dressed in a dark green tunic with long sleeves. He was busy folding something and barely looked up at our approach. His aloofness matched the elegance of his surroundings, but Mito took one look at him and judged him to be a menial, not the proprietor.
"We're here to see Mamercus," he said.
The clerk looked at Mito with heavy, lidded eyes.
"Do you have an appointment?"
"We do not, but we do have need of the best toga-maker in Rome."
"It's impossible without an appointment."
The man reached for a large wax tablet on which a calendar of the month had been drawn.
Perhaps you could come back some time after the Ides?
Not on a holiday, of course. No, we have need of Mamurkas at once. I drew Mito aside and spoke in his ear.
Son, I can speak for myself.
Nonsense, Papa. Do you think Caesar ever deals directly with menials? No, and nor should you. I'm quite used to doing this sort of thing for him. Allow me to do it for you.
Mito spoke just loudly enough for the clerk to overhear. The man took a good look at us, frowned, then turned to push open a thick wooden door and disappear into the back of the establishment. For the brief moment that the door was open, the elegant spell of the vestibule was broken by the smells that issued from the room beyond. They were typical of any tailor's shop, the odours of dyes bubbling in metal pots, the smoke of burning dung and wood, and the mild stench of urine, an essential ingredient in every fuller's formula for cleaning wool to a bright, lustrous white. A few moments later, the clerk reappeared, followed by a tall, clean-shaven man wearing a dark tunic. A necklace and bracelets of silver and lapis marked him as a man of wealth. He had silver hair and looked even haughtier than the clerk.
"How may I help you?" he said.
"A new senator requires a new toga," said Mito, gesturing toward me as if I were something extraordinary to behold. Mamurkus studied me for a long moment. He was clearly unimpressed, but he spoke with caution.
"A friend and supporter of the dictator, I take it?"
"You flatter me, Taylor," I said. "I am as nothing to Caesar, but he shows favour to me, nonetheless."
"When do you need the toga?"
"On the Ides, or better, the day before."
"Which is the day after tomorrow?" "No, no, that's quite impossible."
"I realize I've come to you on very short notice," I said, "but everyone I've asked has told me that you can work miracles in speedy fashion. Marcus Brutus, Decimus Brutus, Antony..." He twitched as I recited each name. At the mention of Antony, he twitched twice. He looked at me glumly, and I could read his face like a book. In such a world, turned upside down by war, how was a man to tell any more who was important and who was not? Was the nondescript fellow standing before him really the confidant of magistrates and generals? Did the handsome young man with me truly move in the innermost circles of the dictator himself? How many rude but rich Gauls had barged into his shop in recent months, announcing that they were senators and wanting a toga to match their station? Barbarians who had never before worn a toga of any sort in their lives. Mamurkus was the latest scion of a long family business, clothiers to generations of upstanding, respectable Romans. Many of those customers were never coming back, and neither were their offspring, exterminated by the catastrophes of war. Mamurkus wasn't yet at ease with the new customers who had taken the place of the old.
"My name is Gordianus," I said. "You don't know me, nor did you ever know my father or anyone else in my family. I've never been to this shop, but I am indeed about to become a senator, and my induction will take place on the Ides. I must have a senatorial toga. There can be no investiture without proper vestments."
"At least you understand and respect the importance of the toga," said Mamurkus quietly. "But it's impossible, nonetheless. Every senator I know intends to be present at that meeting on the Ides, hundreds of them.
I've been inundated with togas. Togas for mending, togas for washing, togas that need alteration to accommodate a bit of added girth. Those who didn't bring togas to be cleaned or altered came to order brand new togas, so as to look their best at their last meeting with the dictator before he leaves Rome. I don't know how I shall make good on all the outstanding orders I have already. I can't possibly accept another.
But you must have something for my father to wear, said Mito. Perhaps a toga you acquired second-hand, or one that was never retrieved and deemed abandoned by its owner, or perhaps a toga that failed to meet the owner's specification.
Young man, snapped Mamercus. You are asking if I might lower my standards of quality to somehow accommodate your father's needs, and the answer is no. No toga has ever left, or will ever leave, this premises without being perfect in every regard. Perfectly fitted, perfectly cleaned, even perfectly folded, wrapped in linen and tied with string to be carried home by the slave who comes to fetch it. No, no, no. You ask too much of me.
I waved my hand to silence them both.
Mamercus, I understand perfectly what you're saying. I regret that it won't be one of your togas that I shall wear on the Ides, for I should like to be clothed in a garment made with such obvious care and pride. But impossible is impossible. If it can't be done, I assure you, citizen, or rather, Senator Gordianus, I can't supply a toga for you on that date.
Then I must find another solution, I said, giving him a parting nod. I gripped Mito's arm to cut short whatever remark was poised on his lips, and walked toward the door, pulling him with me.
I'll somehow make do with something less than the best, as many a Roman must these days, and in the meantime I will have the consolations of poetry.
I nodded toward the linen-wrapped scroll in Mito's hand.
We leave without a toga, son, but not without the Smyrna.
Chapter 21
But why Smyrna? I asked, prolonging slightly the buzz on my lips as I spoke the first letter.
Because she's the subject of the poem, of course, answered Mito.
We sat in the library of my house, which was lit by a great many lamps. Night had fallen. Dinner had been eaten. Wine had been drunk, a bit more by me than by my son. Bethesda had gone to bed, as had Davis and Diana. Mito and I had retired to the library, where I loosened the drawstring and slipped the scroll from its linen pouch.
No, Mito, when I say, Why Smyrna, I don't question the meaning of the title, but the way it's spelled. And as far as I know, there is no letter Z in the Latin alphabet. In the Greek alphabet, yes, but not in Latin. Not since it was banished many generations ago by our wise ancestors. The great Appius Claudius said about the letter Z that the man who makes such a sound produces a facial expression like as that of a grinning skull. Cicero once said to me, Old Appius Claudius achieved many a great thing, the Appian Way, the Appian Aqueduct, but his other achievements pale beside his banishment of the letter that shall not be named.
I'm sure Cicero was joking, Papa.
I'm exaggerating, perhaps, but not joking. Cicero takes letters very seriously. But as I was saying, since the poem is in Latin, why did Cinna spell the girl's name in Greek fashion instead of in Latin with an S?
Smyrna.
Smyrna seems a bit, precious.
Mito laughed.
Oh, Papa, if you start by finding the title pretentious, I fear to imagine what you'll make of the actual verses. But you make a good point, even before the poem begins with the very first letter of the title. Cinna announces to his reader that we are about to enter a web of complex and sophisticated language, full of word games and esoteric references. The same announcement is made to the listener who hears the poem recited, since at the very outset the reciter must say that dreaded letter, pulling back the lips and baring the teeth. Cinna very deliberately chose to title his poem Smyrna, and you, Papa, picked up on the significance of that choice right away. I'm impressed.
I was gratified by his praise, even as a part of me dreaded the sesquipedalian word games I was likely to encounter with each turn of the scroll. Could I even get through the poem? And if I did, would I feel a complete dunce by the end?
Perhaps I should read it on my own, silently, to myself, I suggested.
Oh, no, Papa. A Latin speaker's first reading of the Smyrna is one of life's richest literary pleasures. I want to share it with you. We can take turns reading aloud to each other.
Was this a pleasure he had shared with Caesar in their tent on long wintry nights up in Gaul, or in stolen moments on the banks of the Nile? I felt a curious stab of jealousy. But here was Mito, not merely offering but insisting that we read the poem together. I could hardly refuse. With all this talk of Smyrna, the outcome of her story had come back to me. Having offended an Olympian goddess, I couldn't remember which, poor young Smyrna fled from the lands of the Greeks into the wilds of Arabia. On the point of death, she was transformed into a small, twisted tree. Her tears became the sap of the tree, the precious substance, myrrh, a word derived from her name. I had also remembered that this wasn't quite the end of the story. Even as Smyrna became a tree, a child emerged from her woody womb. That child was Adonis, who would eventually become the beloved of Venus. Did this mean that Smyrna was pregnant before she fled to Arabia? Who was the father of Adonis? I had no recollection of that part of the myth. My ignorance was about to be rectified by Cinna's poem. The story wasn't recounted in a straightforward fashion. If Cinna's vocabulary was challenging, the structure of his poem was perhaps more so. It jumped about in time and space and shifted points of view, yet somehow never lost coherence. Each fragment, complete and perfect in itself, somehow connected with every other fragment, so that the whole was greater than the sum of its parts. The very cadence of the poem cast a spell, as did the musical quality of the language, sometimes as playful as a flute, sometimes as frantic and unsettling as the rattle of a maenad's tambourine, sometimes as bewitching as the plaintive notes of a lyre heard by moonlight. I thought I would prefer those moments when Mito read aloud, for he had a beautiful voice and knew exactly where to place each stress, depending on the secret meanings of the words. But I enjoyed just as much the experience of reading the verses aloud myself, letting my lips and tongue play upon the absurdly convoluted edifice of language. Even when I didn't quite understand what I was reading, the words themselves produced music. When I did understand not merely the outermost level of meaning, but also the multiple puns and learned references, I felt an added thrill, as if the words that emerged from my mouth were truly something more than air, compounded of some enchanted substance that encircled and gently caressed both Mito and myself. Enraptured as I was by the spell of the language, it was only gradually that the story
of the poem crept up on me. From the outset, every detail seemed strangely familiar, like a dream forgotten, then experienced again. Had I once known the story of Smyrna and deliberately forgotten it? A dream or nightmare is perhaps the best comparison I can make to my experience of Smyrna's story that night, sometimes spoken by Mito, sometimes spoken by myself. It seemed at once I slept and yet was awake, that I was an active participant in the story, but at the same time a passive, impassive dreamer. The tale of Smyrna seemed very far away, a figment of a distant past, and yet at the same time terribly near, like an object almost touching one's eyeball, tiny, yet unimaginably monstrous. It was the wine intoxicating me, changing my reality, I thought. Then I realized I hadn't touched my cup since our reading began. A slave appeared from time to time to replenish or replace the lamps. This silent, flitting figure seemed like a shadow visitor from some other world. The poem certainly achieved one goal of such a work, and more profoundly than I had ever before experienced. I forgot complete the cares and distractions of the workaday world. The Smyrna created its own world, which seemed in some impossible way to be more real than the one where I fretted and fussed each day. A summary of Smyrna, the story, can't possibly convey the power of Smyrna, the poem. Those who can read Latin must read it for themselves to understand what I experienced that night, and indeed still experience any time I happen to pick up that poem and scan even a few verses. But here I will tell her story in bare detail. The setting of the tale was the island of Cyprus, in the long-ago days when it was ruled by King Cinyras and his queen, Cencreus. Of all the men in the world in those days, Cinyras was the most handsome, with a beauty to rival that of Achilles or even Apollo. It was more from her father than from her mother that their daughter Smyrna inherited her beauty. Even as a child, she was strikingly lovely, and with each year that passed the girl grew yet more alluring. Queen Cencreus, proud of her daughter's beauty, which far surpassed her own, if not that of her husband, boasted at a public banquet where all could hear that Smyrna was even more beautiful than Venus. What madness possessed Cencreus to make such a claim, which could only give offence to the goddess? From high Olympus, hearing her name invoked, Venus pricked up her ears. She overheard the boast. She flew faster than a comet across the sky and stopped above the island of Cyprus to look down at the royal assembly, narrowing her gaze until it fixed on young Smyrna. The girl was on the very cusp of womanhood, her body still soft and smooth like that of a child, yet beginning to show the shapely contours of a woman's hips and breasts. Her face, likewise, was exactly poised between the innocence of a child and the allure of a woman. Her beauty was poignant, seductive, breathtaking, the beauty of all women and yet of none. For no such beauty as that of Smyrna had ever existed among mere mortals, except in the person of her father. Venus had expected to find the queen's boast frivolous and hollow. Instead, she was taken aback by what she saw. The goddess was not pleased. Venus considered how she might avenge herself on the boasting queen and her daughter. She summoned Cupid and whispered in his ear,
grasping his bow and arrow, the winged cherub flitted downward to the island of Cyprus. He took aim not at the beautiful king or the boasting queen, but at their daughter, who let out a gasp as the arrow struck her breast, and then,